In about a billion years, things get really hot, and we will need all technology, all hands on deck, to engineer our own planet not to overheat and kill everything we've ever known. We're talking about species survival in the future, way, way into the future, and why it matters to have a plan. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Geneticist Chris Mason says we have an extraordinary gift as a species to be able to think far, far ahead, and we need to use this to our advantage. Where do you think humans will live in the future? What do you imagine vast generation starships being like, taking generations to reach their destination? 800-642-1234. Chris Mason is a geneticist and computational biologist who has been a principal investigator and co-investigator of seven NASA missions and projects. He's an associate professor at Weill Cornell Medicine. His new book is called The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. And he's a native of Racine. Chris, welcome back to the Ideas Network and welcome home.
Hello. Well, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you make no bones about it. Earth will go poof, come to an end one day. But to extrapolate a billion years or more seems really audacious to know what will happen to our planet. How can you make these predictions when there are so many variables?
Well, we base everything mostly on what are just known cosmological facts, you know, things that we anticipate coming. And it's just imagining the sun will come up tomorrow and planning ahead is just doing that again, but for a billion years. And we just know that our time, well, you know, Earth is wonderful and it's fantastic. And we've obviously accomplished a lot as a species. Our time here is not going to be permanent. And so if you think ahead, there's a lot of excitement about missions to Mars and some recent work. We have a helicopter now on Mars. But looking farther and farther ahead in time, you know, we know that at some point we'll have to look to another star. And so what's extraordinary is we used to not know any stars that had planets, but now we have hundreds that might be good planets that we could actually land on. And we have the knowledge of biology and the ability to think about how we could survive based on a lot of missions we've done in the past few years.
So it sounds like there are a lot of options on the table for us, but why should we today care about people 500 years in the future?
Yeah, good question. And I think a lot of times people propose missions to Mars or other planets or even out to space as just the next step for exploration, that humans always climb mountains and cross oceans and just explore for the sake of exploration. But I actually propose it in my new book as a moral duty, as something that we are the only species that have an awareness of extinction at all. And so this means that we have a unique understanding and a unique responsibility, not just for staying alive ourselves, which of course is nice, but also to serve as the shepherds and guardians for life as we know it. And eventually, just by looking ahead, that means we'll have to eventually go and do this on other planets. And so I think I just summarized what is the state of the art in the field of genetics and cell engineering and genome engineering, and then also what we can see for planets ahead of us. And so I think this is really kind of the duty for our species.
So if you say that we're so extinction aware that we're the only we're the only ones out there that can do something about this, why aren't we acting more urgently?
Just because we can do something well, we certainly have not always done it well. But I think we have gone through a bit of an adolescence as a species, really just in the past few decades, is that we only really began to understand concepts like geoengineering or, you know, tracking our entire ecosystem and environment and planet and being able to measure it is only the first step in being able to address it. And again, we couldn't do that until the past few decades where we had satellites and technology and monitoring systems to begin to track the changes. But now we do, and we already have some success stories, like getting rid of chlorofluorocarbons that were leading to a hole in the ozone layer as a global effort. We identified and corrected that problem, and we are beginning at least to understand the challenges with climate change and thinking about, you know, serving as shepherds of the whole planet for a long time and trying to avoid what some are calling a pending sixth extinction. So I think we have, you know, but we had to go through this kind of adolescence as a species where we had to deploy probably some unfortunate polluting, methods for generating energy. And now we're getting better at making non-polluting forms of generating energy. And we didn't have a global communication system where you could, you know, Zoom or call up anybody on the planet we only had the really scratches of the beginning of that a few decades ago, but now it's commonplace. So I think we finally have a global infrastructure to address global problems, and that really is very new.
Chris Mason is with us, geneticist, computational biologist, author of the new book, The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. And you can join in. Do you think the human race will eventually have to leave Earth? Under what conditions? And what are your thoughts on the future of genetic engineering? Join in at 800-642-1234. You know, you mentioned going to Mars and our work there to get to Mars and establishing a Mars base camp. What is our interaction, interactions there, and what will we need to do in order to establish a colony or move further?
We basically will need enough of the resources to get to Mars, to live there sustainably, to have basically resource recapture, so like liquid and solid waste. You know, you take it for granted, of course, on Earth, you just flush the toilet, don't think about it. But when you're in a planet that has very limited resources, you want to really get reclamation of all waste, even if it's solid or liquid waste. I think if anyone saw the movie with Matt Damon, The Martian, even the things you flush down the toilet could be fertilizer, right? So we want to use every molecule that is coming with us or even, you know, excreted from us either way. To be used for other creatures and keeping us alive. So these reclamation efforts, again, seem, you know, kind of peculiar. Like, for example, on the space station, it's about 97 or 98% of all the water gets processed and reclaimed and is used again. It includes sweat, includes urine, of course, any moisture. Scott Kelly, who we studied from one of our missions, was in space for a year. He was interviewed once and said, "Is it true that you drink your own urine on the space station?" And he smiled and said, "Well, it's not just my urine, you know, so it is a process where you have to get every bit of moisture and water you can and purify it and use it again." So, so the same things would appear on Mars. And I also describe in the book ways that you can engineer plants and engineer microbes to give us more sustenance. And you could even potentially make it so the human genome, for example, could make its own vitamin C. Today, it can't do that, but with small changes, you can make it so we could avoid scurvy and wouldn't have to have as much vitamin C from our diet, but you could make it natively inside your own cells.
Well, you mentioned astronauts and, you know, astronauts Scott and Mark Kelly, they underwent the twin study and you led the genomics mission on the twin study back in 2015. Mm-hmm. What is the role of astronauts in understanding how we do get to other planets? And what were you trying to find out through the twin study?
Yeah, we were excited to be, you know, one of the principal investigators for that study, focusing a lot on the genetics, as you just said. We really wanted to use that mission as a sketch of what happens to the body at a fine grain and molecular level when you're in space for a year. Because some of the other missions that we know are coming would be potentially a 3-year mission, for example, to Mars, if you go there and back. And so we wanted to use a lot of the modern tools to understand changes in cells, in genes, in tissues, in the whole body, and even also in cognition, what happens to your brain and your reaction time. So we really brought the whole kitchen sink of modern, basically biochemistry, molecular biology, and genetics to bear for this study. And we actually found that the human body is extraordinarily plastic. So, you know, many things change. Actually, almost everything that could change did change, including, you know, his microbes in his gut, to on his skin, to genes in his cells. His immune system was on high alert. But for all these changes, most of them came back to normal, including things like his telomeres got longer when he was in space, which is also normally a sign of being younger when you have longer telomeres. So in some sense, the fountain of youth was found a little bit in space, but that also came back to normal when he got back to Earth. And so what we did find, though, there are other changes to damage to his DNA where we could see the radiation. You could actually see it even coming out in his urine as well as in his blood, that the broken and damaged DNA was being actively repaired by his body. And so it gave us a bit of a clue of what is the body doing to protect itself from the radiation and how can it adapt. And we basically use that as a way to monitor now future astronauts, other ones for NASA who are flying up later this year, and also for SpaceX in September. We'll be monitoring them as well. So it gives us a roadmap of the things we want to watch for in astronauts, and also what we can do to prepare for longer missions.
Yeah, and you found like his immune system was both fighting him, but also trying to help him at the same time. Like, you talked about how his ankles ballooned when he came back. What were some of the physical things that he went through back on Earth?
Yeah, it was really extraordinary to see. Basically, when he got back, his skin broke out in rashes after being in space for a year. Everywhere that touched anything, he had this rash, including just the weight of clothing on his skin. He had not felt for a year. So even wearing clothes became a bit of a nuisance. And so he just, you know, wanted to avoid touching anything. And it only lasted for a few days, but his ankles swelled up to the size of basketballs. And again, it was very painful, but it went after a couple of days, it went away. We could see in his blood work these pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory markers all actively trying to correct the body and trying to figure out how to be this moment of, oh, you know, crap, I'm back on gravity, and trying to deal with that at a cellular level. And eventually it did. So about after 2 days, it was okay. But some of the same signatures of stress that we saw in his blood, we see sometimes in COVID-19 patients. For example, one molecule is called interleukin-6, where you can see the same thing. So we can see his body struggling, but eventually it did recover, which was great to see.
We're discussing how to preserve humanity, expand to other planets, the role of astronauts, and survival tactics, looking at a 500-year plan. Biophysicist Chris Mason is charting this out for us. What do you want to know about long-term space travel? What science fiction movies about space travel could become reality? What curiosities do you have about how humans can really adapt and beat extinction? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're looking at a roadmap, a 500-year blueprint to engineer and protect life as we know it far into the future. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. There is no question that Earth will end. Data are limited, vague as to when, but geneticist Chris Mason says, given enough time, we will explore other galaxies and engineered life will be a new kind of poetry that moves between stars. Can you imagine what a generation ship mission would be like? What else is out there? Where could humans logically live? Join in 800-642-1234. The book is called The Next 500 Years, and geneticist Chris Mason is with us for the hour. John from Wabasha, Minnesota, called in, couldn't stay with us, Chris. And John wonders, what other forms of life might be on a trip to another world? Would it only be humans? What might we see?
Yeah, that's a great question, because we think, you know, about the human cells and protecting humans. But of course, inside of our gut, we have a lot of, you know, billions and even trillions of microbes there, as well as in our skin. So we'd want to think about microbial life. And that's actually one of the best places to look for alien life on Earth, is to look at the nooks and crannies of the most extreme places on Earth, the most extreme temperatures, pressure, toxicity, really heavy radiation loci. We know that life has adapted in almost every place we've looked on Earth. And so it's possible that, you know, you could have strange forms of life that have, instead of, you know, the normal four bases we think of that comprise the genetic code, A, C, G, and T, you can have slight chemical tweaks to them that make it so they're just a little bit different. And actually, some of them have already been made in our lab and in other people's laboratories, where instead of having four letters of the genetic code, the alphabet of life, if you will, to comprise all the poetry of genomes, you could have six letters or even eight or even more that have been basically created in laboratories. And so we know that it's possible to make genetic systems that are alien already on Earth. And so when we go out to other planets, there is a decent chance we'll find something that is not at all like what's on Earth, but it might look like something on Earth as well. And we just don't know. But this is, you know, we've been working with the Perseverance rover and basically looking at sequence data, the sequence information in the clean room where they build the robot, and what might come back from Mars, and been preparing for something that, if it looks like Earth-based genetic material, we'll probably recognize it. But if it's very different, we'll have to try some other tools to even detect it.
Well, Chris, what about like humanoid robots for testing on other planets? How will we send either people or robots to do this work?
I think we'll need both. This is an old debate in really space biology and in aerospace medicine is, you know, do we really need to send humans there? We're really not built for space. We're, you know, we get puffy in space. We have to deal with the radiation, whereas machines do a really good job. And I think we'll need machines for some places that are too dangerous. So definitely we'll want, you know, all these avenues to bear on any of the most dangerous missions, especially. We want to bring them all to the table to be used. But in AI, I think if any of you have, you know, some, you know, home devices like Echoes in your houses, you can talk to Siri or Alexa. Although I probably shouldn't say that name on the radio because everyone's device probably just popped up. But the, you know, I think we've all gotten really used to this, these helpers that are just with us. And so I think hopefully they won't become evil like they do in some movies, but I think they will very much be a part of the mission. And for some of the most dangerous parts, we'd send them off to explore for us.
What do we have to do to soup up human beings to do this work and to live comfortably somewhere else than Earth?
I describe in the book that a lot of the amazing recent tools and recent advances in genetics and epigenetics, which is kind of the controlling layers on genetics, that have been used therapeutically, that we're using in the hospital today, that we're using in testing in my laboratory at Cornell, where we're seeing you can actually add components of genes to cells so they can resist more radiation, or you know, you can control genes and very exquisitely to respond to threats. And, you know, this sounds like science fiction, but it is actually already being deployed therapeutically where we've engineered cells and then put them into patients. One of the most notable examples is in cancer therapy is something called chimeric antigen receptor T cells or CAR T therapies. And this is really genetic engineering of cells and sometimes with CRISPR, which is a way you can modify the genome of the immune cells, putting them into patients and these modified states so they can go and kill the cancer cells. And there, you know, there's not one or two. There are actually hundreds of clinical trials globally where these are being deployed. So what's extraordinary is I describe in the book that we have this really explosion of tools to very precisely control how cells function and what tools the cells have to go, in the case of the immune system, attack cancer cells. But we could add all sorts of things. You could add genes. You could modify genes, take genes from one species and put it into human genes. And really the goal of the book is to describe the evolutionary lessons that are inscribed in the DNA of all creatures, serving as a genetic toolbox that could help us, I think, stay alive for these really long missions.
Chris Mason is with us, a geneticist and computational biologist. He's the author of The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. Where do you think humans will live in the future? What do you want to know about long-term space travel and where to go next? 800-642-1234. Chris, let's jump ahead to phase 7 of your plan. It's around the year 2250. We've been living on Mars. We've unlocked genetic engineering, as you've discussed, and we're getting ready for long-term space travel to find our next home. Who is going on this mission?
I would love it if everyone could go, actually. I mean, it'll be a choice. Not some people would want to just stay on Earth, and that would be wonderful. They should stay. But I think we'd want to enable a real cellular liberty as well as planetary liberty. And what I mean by those two terms is that the cells that you're given could be, you know, slightly modified to enable you to live on Mars or other planets, or that you would have therapeutics that are given. So most days we think of this today where you just take an antibody therapy, for example, is a therapeutic derived from another organism that you use for yourself. So ideally there would be a full cellular liberty where you either have your cells slightly modified so you could survive, or you take lessons from other creatures and use it as a therapeutic. And then eventually you have planetary liberty, where maybe you could go between Mars and Earth, and eventually we would find the other planets that are in the Goldilocks zone that are maybe just warm enough for humans could survive. And again, what's extraordinary is that we knew of none of these planets until 1992. The first exoplanet was discovered outside of our solar system. But now there are thousands of them found, and actually several hundred look like they could be in that sort of nice temperate zone where humans could land and potentially survive. And so I think we would want to make it open for anyone who wants to go, but it would probably be a one-way trip. And in fact, if it's a generation trip, it would be a one-way trip on one spacecraft.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about these generation ships, these spacecrafts. What is a generation ship? What would it be like?
Yeah, so the generation ship is something that has been talked about for over 100 years from a variety of scientists and NASA engineers, is that for some of the distances between stars, if it's too long, you know, given current propulsion methods, you may have to have not just one crew, but multiple crews that would live and die across many generations. The estimate I put in the book is for one of the nearest stars that has a habitable planet, it's only 20 generations, which still is a long time, but oh my I think goodness. It's only because it's relatively short that you could get to and actually potentially survive. And so a generation ship is really a portable home that multiple people live and die in the same craft on their way towards one mission.
Chris Mason, a genetics professor at Weill Cornell Medicine. He's telling us about societies of the future as he charts a plan for humans to expand beyond Earth or else. Can you imagine what a society in 2401 would be like? Do we have a moral or ethical obligation to sustain human life? Can we survive? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We are traveling to Mars and well beyond on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, wrapping our heads around these generation ship spacecraft to leave Earth and travel toward another solar system never meant to return. Can we send humans to a planet that is light years away? Is it ethical, even possible, to have multiple generations of humans live and die on the same spacecraft? Where should we go and can we make it? Join in 800-642-1234. The new book is called The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. And geneticist at Cornell, Chris Mason, stays with us. So, Chris, looking at this generation ship a little bit more closely, how would reproduction work?
Yeah, it would be if we had artificial gravity made by rotating platforms, you know, that would be one way to make it easy to just have people live a normal life. But if there was no simulated gravity where they're just, people floating, they would get different over time. And reproduction, you know, officially, there has never been sex on the space station. Unofficially, there's a lot of rumors. But, you know, invariably, if people are stuck in one place for a long time, the things will happen. And then especially if they're supposed to, you know, basically keep an entire, generation alive and then get to the next generation, I think it'd be similar to what happens on Earth. People would have their own private chambers. They'd have their own society. The same thing happens now on the space station. Everyone gets their own small room. They get some privacy. And so I think it would be really just an extension of the culture we have now where people get some of their own time, start to raise their own families. And but it would be different. The humans born in that context would probably be a little bit different over time by the time they got to the new planet.
Well, I would imagine, too, that you'd have a ton of research to do because, you know, a baby hasn't been born in space before. You haven't had astronauts do this experiment.
Yeah, so it is an unknown. It's a big unknown. So that's why I put this to be about 400 years in the future, because I think we'll need a lot of data before we'd actually try this. But it would. We know that embryos, human embryos, have developed in zero gravity. We know that the development can proceed. And mouse babies have been born. So they took a pregnant mouse and flew it up to space. And so we know that birth can happen in zero gravity. So we have enough of the baseline knowledge to think it should be possible. But to really make sure, we would want to make do this like a clinical trial, except with astronauts. So you make sure you can get it to work first for safety, then for efficacy. And also, it'd be an interesting job for a midwife. You have to catch the baby floating through midair potentially. So it would be, we'd want to make sure we iron out all those logistics for sure.
Okay, so how would food production work on the generation ship? How would people eat?
Yeah, so I have a whole section of the book about intriguing ways you can even make new kinds of plants. And this too would probably require a bit of a genetic or epigenetic manipulation of the plants so that they could be basically pack more punch into a smaller area. So you can make these kinds of tomatoes. Again, that everything in the book is, it's a nonfiction book. So I tell stories of things that we know work today that we could use very reasonably in the future. So one is a bushel essentially of tomatoes where it looks almost like a strawberry plant instead of a tomato plant, but you can have these really high energy and high vitamin and protein rich tomatoes be made like little, almost like little bouquets. And, you know, we could engineer those so that they would grow in a very limited environment in terms of resource utilization. So we could bring the plants that are the most hardy and give us the greatest nutrients and grow them actually in zero gravity, as it's been done on the space station.
Let's bring in Michael now in Bear Valley with a question. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Just a quick question for your guest. Very interesting topic and discussion. I was wondering if you could recommend any science fiction authors that deal specifically with this topic. Thank you.
Yeah, so good question. There's, of course, I'm a big fan of science fiction. I like science fiction when it's heavy on the science and also has good fiction and really solid science. So the Martian is a really good book about the trip to Mars. And if you haven't seen the movie, it's a really good representation. Actually, Neil Stephenson recently wrote a book called Seven Eves, which is an interesting preview into what sort of the future of our solar system might look like. And also The Expanse series, which is also a show that you can watch on TV, is
that's a Netflix really intriguing. Series.
Yeah, Netflix series is also. I actually wrote the book before I saw the series, and I was really excited to watch it. But it was a very interesting depiction of humanity, because we're in this future where we're going back and forth and all around the solar system and starting to look at other solar systems. But humanity, even in the face of such extraordinary technological development, is still kind of as petty and backstabbing and tribal as they are today, unfortunately. So I'm
some
hoping
things contaminated you can't genetically engineer.
I'm hoping we progress socially as well as technologically in the next few hundred years.
So what do we, you know, you've talked about Titan. What do we need to consider when looking for a new home planet? Like, what are some attributes?
There is this great calculation being used by planetary scientists today that I described, you know, later in the book, of, you know, how do we measure what's a good planet to go to? And I think a famous equation people have often heard of is called the Drake equation, which is just trying to understand basically how likely is it that life exists on any other planet in the universe. And it's an estimate, you know, we don't obviously know. Currently the answer is zero of what we know, but estimates range from hundreds of worlds to maybe thousands where there could be microbial life, just based on some preliminary numbers. And recently there's something that's expanded on that that's called the Seeger equation, which is looking for these biosignatures of life in the atmosphere. And we actually think that based on current projections, again, there's probably at least hundreds where we could go today as humans and probably survive, just based on the distance from the sun and the planetary measurements of their density and radiation and temperature. But we also think that there's potential life signatures we're now beginning to see in the atmospheres of these other planets. And again, if not something was found, you would have heard about it by now, but there's enough good candidates that we're building more telescopes and thinking about ways to go there and take the chemistry that exists on a new planet or a new moon and use it. So, for example, Titan has methane lengths, which is a really good hydrocarbon. Mm. So actually getting fuel on Titan would be really easy, except that it's really cold there, so you'd have to make sure you can stay warm.
Okay, so you've got these, you know, good things and bad things, like you have to kind of weigh them and which one is more meaningful to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Both. You want to weigh, you know, what is the difficulty of the mission or settling a planet, or again, even think about engineering a planet. It seems weird to think about, could you engineer the atmosphere of a whole planet? Until you realize that's actually what we're already doing today. When we all talk about climate change and serving as stewards of this planet, we are thinking in a planetary scale of engineering and keeping track of our atmosphere to make sure it doesn't go in a direction that is threatening to us. So if we do it to another planet, it's actually the second time that we'll be doing planetary scale engineering.
Yeah, but do we have enough time to get to other planets and to do this science in the face of the calamity that is climate change?
I think so. I guess I'm optimistic, because I think that in the case of carbon emissions and methane, we now can measure it and see it quite well, whereas 30, 40 years ago, we had just a beginning sketch of what it looked like. And our biggest fear was that we'd become like Venus, which is a large, you know, basically an overheated planet because it's so much carbon dioxide. But we didn't have really the detailed measurements and also tools to begin to address it. There's now multiple technologies where you can engineer microbes that can suck out carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Obviously, plants do this quite well. There's been multiple analyses that show if we just planted enough plants, it would probably actually solve the problem. And so what I'm really inspired by is the fact that this is a technical problem that is solvable and really already solved. So the biggest challenge now is just the political will to make it happen. So I think it'd be much more terrifying if the planet was getting warmer and we had no idea why, for example. But here we know what to do. It's just about willpower to do it.
Genetics Professor Chris Mason from Cornell with us as we look at a 500-year plan for humans and what happens after Earth. Taking your questions, should we be preparing for life beyond Earth? Do you think we have a responsibility to protect all life as guardians? 800-642-1234. Mark is joining us from Neenah with a question. Hi, Mark.
Hello there. Great subject. I appreciate it. I just want to know what the guest either thinks about or knows about in rocket propulsion. You know, I mean, I'm a big Star Trek fan, and they had, like, warp engines and whatever that meant, you know. And is there work going on to try to replace the conventional fired engines with something that's more fast, so that the generational travel that you talked about earlier would be shorter?
Yeah,
good question. And so it would be great if we could get faster propulsions. And everything I do in the book is I presume that I base the future on what we know today. So if we could get faster, like fusion drives, for example, could be happening in the future. But there's an old joke about fusion is that fusion is always 15 years away, and it's always going to be 15 years away, but that it's getting closer all the time. And so I think if that happens, that would cut the time to one of the nearest stars from instead of 20 generations to get there, it could make it as fast as maybe 6 or 7. And so that makes it much more, I think, palatable of a mission for people to think about. But so far, I really, most of the math in the book is based on just what we know today. And, you know, we are getting spacecraft that can go faster when we use gravity assist. So you use a lot of other planets to get places faster, which is very much what we're doing now with the Parker Solar Probe, for example. And I detail other methods like antimatter drives or warp drives, but they're all currently physics speculation right now. So we don't have any easy way to make them. But if any of those succeed, basically, it makes the trip much shorter and makes the planets that we're looking at much closer. So it'd be wonderful if that happens.
It's hard to wrap your head around the fact that this is a very large world, and it's not just about you and your community here getting on a spaceship, but it's the whole world to think about. How do you look at this plan but also see it on a global scale?
I think the plan is I really wrote it as kind of a treatise of hope and I think duty for humanity. So I think this is something that people, when you think of duty in most cases, it's usually a really boring subject. If you want to make someone not talk to you at a party, you could ask them, what do you think your duty is in life? You know, so it's not because it's the most exciting subject, but it's because it's the most essential subject in the long term, is that this is a duty that people often find for their life. They can sometimes abdicate, even duty to children, duty to country, duty to a cause. You can switch in some cases, or you can neglect children, unfortunately. But I think the duty to our own species and to all species is something that is unique to us. It's something only we can understand and something that only we can act on. And so it is a unique feature of humanity. And maybe someday it could be other creatures, like maybe artificial intelligence I discuss in the book. Someday it could become self-aware and also serve as guardians. But this really is a duty for the whole planet and for everyone on it, and for everyone that will probably come in the future.
We're talking about the steps and stages to nearly limitless human possibility with Cornell Weill Medicine Genetics Professor Chris Mason is with us. What do we need today to survive on new worlds? What do you think society will be like in 2500? Can we evolve fast enough? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chris Mason on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing radical genetic modification of humans and creating remote space colonies in order to protect and extend life in the universe. What do you want to ask about the limits of life? How far can it go? What do you want to know about Titan, for instance, sitting at the outer edge of the solar system? Are we really open to adapting and thriving? Are we all in? The book is called The Next 500 Years, and Chris Mason is explaining his long-range plan for humanity. Chris, we heard from Vern in Eau Claire, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Vern says that a massive asteroid is predicted to hit Earth in 150 years, much larger than what hit the Yucatan Peninsula. It will wipe out life on Earth. Have you factored this in? Vern asks.
Yes, the sooner the better that we could get to other planets. And it's not because we want to leave Earth because we don't like it here. It's just because there's a chance that something like that could happen. So going to Mars and going to other planets is not plan B. It is just plan A. And, you know, I talk about in the book that I'm hoping that 500 years would be enough time for us to enact these goals and begin to go not just to Mars, but to other planets, and eventually to get a craft out towards another solar system. But that is indeed one of the reasons why when people say, oh, this is so far away, why should I care? It's because there's plenty of things that could go wrong, like asteroids, like problems in climate, or, for example, recently we've all experienced a global pandemic, which could have actually potentially been worse. And so, you know, I really want to think about the ways to walk and chew gum at the same time, where we address challenges on Earth today and, you know, really systemic inequalities and poverty and crime here, while also looking out towards the stars.
Yeah, walk and chew gum. I think this is along the lines of what John from Brown Deer called in to ask about, couldn't stay with us. And, you know, he said that he thinks escaping to another planet is a useless fantasy. John says we should spend our energy solving political and social and environmental problems right here. And John makes the point, we can't even solve the COVID pandemic. What would you say?
Well, to that I'd say, you know, it definitely can do both at the same time. You know, this is what's often called a false dichotomy, where you have to do one or the other. But we have been pursuing space flight for decades now, and slowly improving aspects of society. And I would point out that all the technology that's enabled us to, you know, get a vaccine within a matter of months being deployed in clinical trials for the emergence of SARS-CoV-2 for COVID-19 virus is extraordinary. And that actually was, you know, driven by technological innovation and investment in science. And so I think even though the pandemic was awful, the fact that we have a way to rapidly counteract it and have diagnostic tests and therapeutics and a vaccine all in less than a year is nothing short of extraordinary. And you know, if you really, only do one thing where you only address, you know, sociological challenges, but don't think about the technological challenges, then we would have been caught more flat-footed or even completely flat-footed relative to the virus. So I think we can do both, and we have to do both.
I was thinking about the genetic engineering of humans and this idea of whether we can reverse aging or stop aging, and thinking about the space travel and putting a body to sleep, maybe like hibernation. Where do you see aging in this whole plan, and what science can do to aging?
I think for aging, we now can measure it much better. Like most things in science, we have extraordinarily new tools to measure things that we couldn't really see before. So aging, I think we'll be able to push back. I don't predict anywhere in my book that we'll be able to stop aging. We just don't have any way to do that yet. We know that we could, you know, look at other creatures like tortoises that live for over 200 years. Some plants live for thousands of years. We know it's possible for life to live a long time. But nothing has really beat out and tricked the Grim Reaper yet. So we think eventually something will die. But that's actually, I think, a very liberating place to be, is to know that you'll die and think, well, then what can I do for those that will come after me? And so I think that you will see more and more longevity being deployed in these tools that can keep people alive longer and even healthier longer, where it's not just lifespan, but the health span. And I think that'll also apply to some of the long-term missions. We'd use all those tools to keep people as healthy as long as possible. But I don't know if we'll live to be, say, 1,000 years anytime soon, but we could certainly could push it back a little bit.
Okay, so on these missions and being the genetic guardians, as you say we are, you know, what about the animals and the organisms and the plants? Like, who will come with us? How will we decide?
It's a bit like Noah's Ark in a sense, a modern version of it, is that we try to bring as many of them as we could. And if we can't bring them physically, we could actually at least have their genetic code. So when we sequence the DNA of any organism, it builds a genetic catalog of what how they've survived on this earth and what adaptations they have learned to make it. And so we can, at the very least, bring the information with us to essentially, you know, recreate some of those species on a new planet. Or I think more interestingly, I talk about in the book, is that we'd soon to have interplanetary evolutionary biology. We would learn how do different organisms adapt when you get to Mars or you get to other planets, and then look at those organisms, whether it's bacteria or plants or animals, sequence their DNA, learn how they've adapted. Then you could basically send the data back to Earth. So you could actually then do further work where you have a lot more resources here on Earth to understand those adaptations and have this continual virtuous cycle of learning about how life adapts in different planets, not just on one planet, which I think would lead to a lot more interesting discoveries of what other plants and animals we could bring with us and also protect on other planets.
Chris Mason with us, geneticist, computational biologist, author of the new book, The Next 500 Years. Chris, you've worked on 7 NASA missions and projects. I'm wondering, do you see NASA moving fast enough on these types of experiments and this type of thinking? Is our agency keeping up?
I think, actually, you know, I wish there was more funding for NASA. It definitely would help it go faster, but it's working very fast and everything that's in low Earth orbit, but also looking out, you know, I think beyond that. So recently, NASA has given a lot of commercial spaceflight grants and projects, as people have probably heard about, like SpaceX is going to be running some of the new moon landings. And there's also Blue Origin and other sort of commercial spaceflight that's being really engineered for all the low Earth orbit, all the kind of the relatively easy missions. There's now lots of players. So I think, you know, instead of it all being just in NASA, what they've done strategically is to say, let's get more and more interesting competition for things that are just close to Earth. And we'll have multiple missions this year that are, you know, short-term missions, but putting multiple people in flight. So I think if you look at NASA, it's no longer just about NASA, but other groups that it's funding, other companies. The commercial spaceflight realm is really expanding, which I think is great because it gives us a lot more shots on goal, a lot more chances to develop technology.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned 583 people have been to space at this point.
That's it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, short term here, considering how you think. But in the next 5 years, what might that number be like?
It could be another, actually, maybe even several hundred. So we could, if we do things right and all the missions that are being planned come to fruition, we would actually see that number may even double in the next 5 years. So we may have taken, you know, 50 years to get to the first sort of 500, but maybe we'll double that in a matter of about 5 years, assuming that everyone gets up and going as fast as they're talking about. So it's a really exciting time. It's basically the new version of the space race, except it's not just countries racing. It's countries, companies, nonprofits. It's a really exciting time. And really, there's been more launches last year than any other year, 2 times higher of things that went into space. And so it's a really exciting time. It's Space Race 2.0, if you will.
We only have a couple seconds left, though. But what gives you hope about this plan that is still so fuzzy, so blurry?
My hope is that everything is possible. So nothing requires a dramatic change in technology. It's just about implementing the technology we already have and doing it in organized fashion and responsible and careful fashion. But this is something we can do. This is a roadmap of something that is possible today and then over the next few years. So I think it's a very exciting time. It's quantifiably the best time ever to be alive as a human, and it should only get better.
Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Chris Mason is a geneticist and computational biologist. He's the author of The Next 500 Years, Engineering Life to Reach New Worlds. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.